Hello and welcome to Season 1, Episode 5 of Slamhammer, Australian Warhammer 40k and Kill Team Podcast. My name is Will of Crossblade Studios and I'll be your host. Can I just say thank you again to everybody who's tuned into the podcast over the past few weeks. It has been absolutely mad putting together podcasts with this kind of release schedule. It is one that I endeavour to maintain alongside work and everything else going on. but it is great to see that people are engaging and asking questions and seeking, you know, pointers to the podcast itself on Spotify and Anchor and Apple Podcasts. So thank you so much for taking that interest. We're still locked down to a degree in Victoria where this podcast is produced. I know that restrictions are starting to lift in Australia in places. Places like Games Workshop, however, are still closed for basically anything other than running in for a quick purchase. So there is not much to share in that particular respect. However, independent stockists such as General Games are starting to relax some of their store policies around coming in and playing games. So if you do have any of those local game stores that are opening up to those kind of things again, I do encourage everybody to get out and support their local game store in a way which doesn't merely focus on vying for that one Catachan kernel that everybody's after. I know that they all did it tough, and two or three models doesn't do a great deal to support a store's bottom line. I think we all know that. But while we're all out there supporting our local game stores, we're also waiting for new details on 9th edition and some of the new models coming out. The details on the Skorpec Destroyers are now available. Bell of Lost Souls did a feature on them just very recently. And it was interesting to have a look at those as kind of like the in-between model for your Warriors and the Skorpec Lord, which is the big nasty at the end of that 9th edition trailer. The Hyperphase Reap Blade looks like it's going to make these guys an absolute monstrosity. I don't know exactly how parallel this particular blade is to the Incubi's blades, but these things are absolutely monstrous for what is presumably a strength 4 or 5 creature already. Giving them plus 2 strength, AP of neg 4, and a damage of 3 is absolutely brutal. I was rather frustrated with the orientation of 40k towards shooting. These guys look like they're pushing it in the other direction, and accordingly I think they're going to be big targets that would make a big deal to any 40k game to have these guys tripedal organisms running across the table to go and absolutely mash units in melee. What more can be said? They're absolutely monstrous, and there's probably going to be a shooting variant as well, I would say. So very exciting to see more on them as time comes out. There are still some Primaris models which have not yet been previewed, so things like the Captain, the new Chaplain, and the Hell Furies. So we'll have more on that when they have been revealed in more detail. This episode takes the very narrative conversation and sort of thematic conversation we had about Chaos Cultists in episode 4 and extends that into Necromunda. But we're also going to talk about Tabletop Simulator for 40k and Kill Team. Why is that? Well, Necromunda gangs are a logical extension of that disorganized group conversation we had in episode 4. And it makes a lot of sense to kind of delve into these guys as the next step beyond a disorganized group with loads of character, and then having a conversation around how you can take that character and put it into 40k and Kill Team, as well as exploring other ways to engage with the Games Workshop hobby. And particularly because we are still locked down and there have been increases to the price of Warhammer, and we all know that 9th edition is probably going to be a very expensive endeavor to start off in, discussing various ways to engage in the hobby which don't require you to take out a mortgage on a house is probably a good move. So this is going to be an exploratory episode that looks at both of these things in more detail, because I've not played Necromunda, I've not played Tabletop Simulator 40K, but these are good opportunities to look at it because these are both different mediums for engagement which players can start to look at in more detail, but also because on Steam, where you'll find Tabletop Simulator, you'll also find the pre-order for Necromunda Under Hive Wars, which has been developed by Rogue Factor Games and published by Focus Home Interactive. This is due for release in summer 2020, so make sure you go check that out and see what you think. When watching the trailer, I got a very distinct British soccer hooligan slash Green Street vibe, which was really, really interesting and really, really entertaining. I look forward to seeing how the Goliaths and the Eshers interact with one another, but also how the other factions come into this. So like House Orlok and Horse Cawdor, and then also the Palanitan forces. What other forces and characters will we see in this game? How will it play? What will it turn out like? I'm very excited to see that. However, I am reserved about post-release support, so I won't be buying it on day one. The disclaimer to say here is Games Workshop IP is not managed overly well post-release for these kind of titles. So be really sure of your purchase before you do so. Games like Battlefleet Gothic Armada 2 have reportedly been abandoned. Dawn of War 3 was abandoned by Relic. But on the same sort of topic, Mechanicus has had a completely different experience. It is released under a different developer and publisher, and reportedly, by all accounts, has fared much better. So do your research, be sure of what you want to do. It looks really interesting, but I don't want people to pour their money into an abandoned and under-loved endeavor. Finally, before we jump to part one, I just want to reiterate that if you have any feedback on the podcast, you can relay that through our social media channels. There is an anchor.fm voice messaging link, which I encourage everyone to use. You can reach us on Instagram at Crossblade Studios and via email at crossbladestudios@gmail.com. I'm also going to produce a Facebook page so that everybody can keep across developments with this podcast, particularly if they're going to be any changes to the release schedule or any interruptions. Because work is what it is. It's coming up to a very important part of the year. I just want to keep everybody posted. So, with all that out of the way, we're going to skip to part one on Necromunda. So welcome back. In this part of this episode 5, we're going to be talking a little bit about Necromunda. And the reason for that is I've been wanting to explore Necromunda from a rules and gameplay perspective for a little while. And because Necromunda draws so much of that punky influence from pop culture, it also resounded with me in a little bit of the same way that earlier 40K did. And in this part of the episode, just want to talk a little bit about that and where the interest came from, but then also to look at some of the really basic rules of Necromunda. I haven't bought Dark Uprising or anything like that, mostly because I tend to get obsessed with some of my hobby projects, and making time for client work tends to erode the time and focus I can give to something like Necromunda as a parallel system. So I thought in this part of the episode just run through some of the basics that Necromunda uses and how that kind of feeds into or draws from Kill Team, and then maybe critically evaluate that in terms of what Kill Team could maybe borrow in its next iteration, because hopefully we'll see Kill Team continue to evolve and borrow the best parts of Necromunda, which really is a far more complex game system than anything in 40K or Kill Team, really. And the main thing I want to touch on just to begin with is that real pop culture connection, because it's always been this real punky and alternative universe. And I don't want to say cyberpunk, because it's almost a little bit of a different genre altogether now. I'd prefer to maybe even just stick to that punk sort of idea, because it takes it into that kind of real spiky and Mad Maxy kind of aesthetic with chains and spikes and poisons and everything else, without kind of pushing it too many things involving robots and all this kind of crazy stuff, even though Necromunda now involves the Ambots. So it might be pushed the other way, but I think you can see the distinction between Necromunda's kind of sci-fi punk ideas and that which is now coming into 40K proper through the Necrons, with all the things I was talking about with that Orwellian Walker type scenario, and the fact that Necrons are starting to develop this tripedal type characteristic in some of their Sculptech models. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes, because I do think there's a lot of potential for 40K to strike out on its own, just take these real extreme notions of what science fiction can be and drive that through its modeling base. But where that is sort of carried away in the 40K universe, Necromunda still remains a bit grounded. So when you think about a faction like the Goliaths, like they seem like they're almost extensions of the Bane and emphasized or roided up Bane that you see from the Batman comics. Because before, the Goliaths were, big, strong guys who carried axes and had this very bruiser type element to them. But now you start to see a few of their models with these vials that seem to be present, and some of their aesthetic is pushing more towards this neo-gladiator type feel. And that was really interesting for me, because I saw that iteration happening and I thought, well, that really takes this idea of the neo-gladiator in a way which made sense, because Goliaths needed to evolve from what they were and some of the old aesthetic, and I feel like they've done that even though some of their models appear a little bit cartoonish. And in the same way, the Escher faction, like they take Amazonian in quite a bright and colourful way that you tend to associate with some of the 1980s punk ideas, without being overly exaggerated in its feel, or I'm going to say sexuality as well, because the Amazonian women are portrayed in an overly sexual way. They're still quite reserved from that respect, and kind of focus on bright colours and feathers and poison and all those sorts of things. And I thought that was really interesting. But what I want to see come from Necromunda next, because we've seen the Palanite Enforcers and the Corpse Grinders, which are very grindhouse, corn type characters compared to the Palanite Enforcers, Arbites kind of feel that kind of takes a degree of artistic influence from the Space Marines, is House Dellark. House Dellark being this quite shadowy and sleek spy kind of faction. I feel like it's be a good place to explore some of the more neo-black black or darkness kind of aspects of the hives. So when I say neo-blackness, what I mean is the super shadowy figures. And I don't want to say noir, because noir, even though it technically means the same thing, still has quite a logical attachment, sorry, to classical portrayals of gangsters and stuff like that. Whereas this blackness kind of emphasizes the absolute dark aspects of the hives and what lurks beyond there. And I think that's kind of what Dellark do. I have taken to like them quite a bit and want to use some of those models in the Inquisitorial henchmen that I'm building, maybe as a kill team, when my hopes that the Inquisition will actually be given rules for kill team, rather than just the occasional model here and there. and Dalak have the right foundations in looking shadowy and slimy, I guess. the kind of people you can't trust, but they're also the type of character that corresponds the most with the cyberpunk theme that you see in things like Cyberpunk 2077. They are the most grounded in reality aside from Orlok. And the reason for that is Orlok is still very connected to this whole Mad Max theme. And if you've played Mad Max, the video game, you'll see even more parallels between what they're trying to portray in these different environments. So I would really like to see them come out as a reimagined faction or even just a adaptation of Delark next, because I feel like that would be a great place to really explore these concepts of what the depths of the hive can be. And particularly because they're all these shadowy figures that rely on deception and, again, things like poison and all those sorts of things. It'd be good to see where they could kind of take that as an iteration, because I don't see things like the Ambots fitting in very well with House Dalak. And while I do see them kind of fitting in more with the Orlok, so what would be interesting is if they were pursued a bit more. But when we take the science fiction theme, they've actually tried to portray this in popular culture a little bit. And the comics of Judge Dredd did portray this kind of universe in some detail, perhaps with some artistic freedoms being injected into that universe. And I saw Judge Dredd, the comics, when I was a lot younger. Didn't really quite have a proper concept of what the 40K universe was, but there are a lot of comics and toys and stuff like that around in my childhood, so I did see a lot of that stuff at the time. But one thing which I didn't know until more recently was in the 1995 portrayal of Judge Dredd, you have Sylvester Stallone, who's actually playing this character in quite a interesting storyline, but at the same time they tried to introduce Rob Schneider into that, which was kind of like a goofiness element to what is really supposed to be quite a grim and dark storyline. I thought that was a really interesting idea, and probably didn't work. I didn't see the 95 Judge Dredd, but by all accounts, it's actually laughably bad. And they've tried to take that and maybe ground Judge Dredd in something more dark and serious in 2012, where they made a Judge Dredd movie featuring Carl Urban, who was Éomer in Lord of the Rings, and Lena Headey, who was Cersei in Game of Thrones. But even then, in that film, Urban's Judge Dredd didn't really resound with me as authentic either. The judge in the 40K universe, as it relates to the Arbites, is really very senior, whereas the arbitrator is probably more likely to be the one who's on the ground doing things in this 40K hivish universe. But even then, like, the Judge Dredd here kind of comes across as a Palinite enforcer sergeant who's really just on the edge and really grunty, and the movie just didn't do it for me. Like, there is a big focus on these drugs in the Necromunda universe as well, and ways in which you can bolster your character's coolness or their resolve. And in this 2012 film, they've got this drug called Slow-Mo, which does this Max Payne-ish slowing down of time thing, and it just didn't really resound with me. So I think if anybody feels the same way I do, they probably wouldn't be surprised if Necromunda is not portrayed any further through universes or stories like Judge Dredd in cinema anymore. I think it's probably had its dash, and it's probably not coming back in the same way that movies like Spawn probably aren't coming back either. lest this kind of podcast episode turn into a movie review or critical discussion special, I'm mindful that we should probably delve into The Underhive to talk more details about Necromunda. Necromunda takes the grimdark narrative of 40K and applies it to the underhives of the Imperium's populace. Now, we're all relatively familiar with that idea. However, what I want to delve into is the way in which this is a system with far more developed and intelligent rules, and then think about how that could apply to the next iteration of Kill Team, just because I think there are some mechanics here which are really very clever, and it's essentially based around skirmishing through gang warfare. And there's a good chance that if Games Workshop wants to take these kind of mechanics and represent them in a 40K universe involving, you know, its mainline range, then it's got to learn from Necromunda, because Necromunda has far and away been a far more complex and more detailed game system. And while 40K as a mainline system starts to go towards this streamlined format, where they're talking about games not taking hours and hours and hours, which is fine and admirable, for people who are really deep in the narrative and really want to get involved with the story as it portrays your models doing certain things, a more complex rule set that draws on different aspects of characters makes more sense. The most extreme form of that, of course, being RPGs where there is no model. It's kind of the same D&D kind of scenario with game masters and stuff like that. And Death Watch does have an RPG which is fundamentally based around these concepts. And of course, there is a broader 40K Wrath and Glory type idea that tries to do the same thing, which I haven't looked at in detail. But, you know, I do suspect that 40K isn't going to really be pushing, because they want people to focus on the models as things that sell. And given that 9th edition is coming out, new edition of Kill Team will hopefully follow, which takes all the good. So let's look at the very basics of rules of Necromunda, because we're not going to get into the really complex. And then we'll have a chat about what could be borrowed or applied in the next iteration of Kill Team, because that's what I really, really like to see. Because the more that we can have a really interesting and in-depth rule system, the better. In Necromunda, the majority of the gangs are going to be immediately recognizable from a statistics standpoint, right? So you've got all the really basic details that you see in 40K, all the way from movement up to leadership. That's fine. But what we also have in Necromunda is a character's cool, which is their capacity to keep calm under fire. Their willpower, which is all about their resilience, particularly when they've been in an engagement for a long time. And then also their intelligence points. So this is their ability, presumably, to interact with the environment, not the militaristic information-gathering type intelligence, which is portrayed in the Kill Team rulebook, but not really explored in any substantive way, so it's kind of meaningless. Right, so already you can see that you're actually giving characters, in inverted commas, character, because they're going to respond to their environments inherently in different ways depending on how these particular statistics are impacted through gameplay. Now, Kill Team doesn't need to be a carbon copy of Necromunda, otherwise you should just be playing Necromunda. But for all those who listen to this podcast and really want to see an improvement in where the Kill Team rules go, can you kind of see what I mean? Like, taking some meaningless traits that you assign to a character that's based off just a rolling table in the Kill Team rulebook really does nothing to give your characters depth or any kind of interesting aspect. Whereas here, we can already see that the cooler a model is, the better they're going to respond to being under pressured environments, and that already seems like a marked improvement on what we see in 40K. and kill team. So, for example, you would presume that a Custode would be the coolest of all the characters, because presumably they would be the calmest and the most capable of dealing with pressured situations, given their inherent role in protecting the Emperor. And you'd also say that a Grey Knight would probably be a character with the most mental fortitude and resilience because of the aspect of their role in fighting the worst of the Chaos Demons, right? So you can already see that there's different ways to interpret a character inherently that doesn't require any extra work or the reading up of traits in a book, which doesn't do anything else for you. And each of your characters also gets to have a skill, and they also get to have war gear. So already, when you talk about the ultra basics of the game, they're giving every single character something which is important, both from a story perspective and from a loadout perspective. And what I would like, without stymieing Kill Team too much, is to maybe give each of your activating individuals something a little bit more than just a command point ability which can be applied to everyone. Why should I care about Marine 1 doing something when I can do it with Marine 2? It makes each of your characters, you know, less individual and more of just this blended group which are leveraging command points to access abilities, whereas in Necromunda, each of your characters can be given something which makes them more unique in their own right. So I think there's also a great way for those kind of characteristics of Necromunda to be applied. However, if you just wanted that to remain the same way, like, that's fine too. There's still plenty that can be borrowed from Necromunda in this way to make your kill teams a little bit more variable and a little bit different inherently than what we're currently seeing. And while I think things like ammunition that applies to weapons and the weapon jamming and all that sort of stuff probably isn't necessary to apply, because we're talking about professional soldiers who are presumably well equipped, particularly in the case of the Imperium. Like, ammo and weapons jamming and all that sort of stuff, like, that is a really interesting aspect of Necromunda, but probably doesn't need to be applied in a kill team environment. And I totally get that. I get why that's there in the Necromunda environment, but I just don't see it being relevant in the broader 40K, because you would think, at least in most cases, that your military groups are being given the very best of everything that the, well, in the case of the Imperium, that the Imperium can provide. But otherwise, you know, taking at least the best that they can. And for Genestealer cults, stealing the best they can. So, another aspect which I think really does need to come back to 40K and Kill Team is scatter dice. Necromunda still does feature scatter dice and templates for their weapons, and I've already spoken previously in episode 4 about why I think scatter dice and templates are really important, so I'm not going to delve into that anymore. I think, suffice to say, in Necromunda, the different statuses combined with things like scatter dice and templates already make the ways which your characters interact not only with their environments but with those other models on the other enemy gang or on the other side a lot more complex. So, for example, with a template, you know, really works well with those flame weapons, right? So you're already seeing that there's a more physical way to engage with the other parts of your environment and the other enemy models. But at the same time, let's say I've got an enemy model and I want to fire a weapon at that model, it can go prone. And when a model goes prone, there are rules which suggest that they don't block line of sight, but also presumably they can interact with their environment in a way in which they can take advantage of cover. So in addition to all these, like your characters can be pinned, and you know there are different ways in which being pinned impacts on your character statuses and the way they respond to different environments. Like it just seems like there are so many more in-depth ways Necromunda attempts to engage all of your different characters with the environment around them and with their opponents. I think there's a lot that 40K and Kill Team can learn. The action phases, they're all very simple. They're all comparable, I guess, to Kill Team. However, there are different actions which a model can take, and it's a basic, a simple, and a double action. And for example, a basic action is something like aiming. So it doesn't require much effort on the part of the model. And if they're taking that basic action to aim, they add plus one to their hit rolls, which kind of makes sense when you've got a character which is a sharp shooter and trying to engage a model, particularly at long range as well. And then a simple action is moving, so very straightforward, and a double action is charging. But in addition to those really interesting things, you can also have models standing up or going prone and interacting with their environments different ways, but also crawling. Like, think about how in depth that is compared to 40K and Kill Team in its current rule set. Like, the way in which 40K Kill Team relies on terrain to really be about maneuvering, you would think that there would be more ways for your different models to interact with these features because they are so central. And if you are able to get, let's say, a Astra Militarum or Chaos Cultist miniature to crawl, you know, perhaps be a neg one to hit when they're moving in that way if they're out in the open, but they would be able to move slower in between different pieces of scenery to slowly move between different aspects of the map and maybe take up different firing positions and open up different arcs and way of maneuvering around something. That would be a really interesting way to open up different tactical options, because I've spoken previously about the way in which giving a heavy weapon to something like Chaos Cultists would allow them to have a little bit more firepower, but would reduce their tactical flexibility. So when you think about Kill Teams which rely very strongly on their firepower, and I would say that those are things like Astra Militarum and the Tau, what they try to emphasize is fire lanes. And a fire lane is any space in between line of sight blocking scenery which allows for them to shoot unencumbered, and effectively funneling your models through these fire lanes means that you know the Tau or the Astra Militarum intend to light up your models as they do that and hopefully score wounds and take them out of action. But the way in which a lot of the maps are set out, there's often pieces of different scenery with different heights and different aspects and stuff like that, which are laid out in different ways across the map. And if you're able to have your model move between those without exposing, let's say, their torso to fire, that actually increases the options which you would have to approach a heavy weapon. So if you take the Astra Militarum example, and then you say you have a thousand sun. It's going to sound like an interesting example, but let's say that you have a thousand sun Chaos Space Marine, which is standing behind cover, right? And your Astra Militarum, again, this is a fairly unrealistic example because of, you know, the whole thematic thing, but let's say the Astra Militarum in this example want to actually assault that Thousand Sun Marine, let's say to move them off of an objective. They can run up to that model which is behind cover and expose themselves to fire, and we all know what the Astra Militarum are like when they're exposed to fire, particularly from Space Marines, and you might lose one or two in that effort, let's say out of a group of four. But if you're able to move between cover in a way which uses things like crawling to remain hidden or to increase your chances of surviving and making it into melee, then doesn't that make more sense to have something like a crawl move in between pieces of cover? Like, if you're trying to maintain a high firing position to maintain a line of sight advantage over your opponent, but your opponent has decided that they want to light you up so you cannot maneuver around and obtain that height advantage in different perspectives, then crawling would help you move your models in a way which would allow them to reposition strategically to obtain another fire arc without requiring them to be exposed to incoming fire. That is such a clever mechanic. It slows your models down because they're crawling, but it is clever because it allows for obstacles to be used in ways which increases tactical flexibility. And I can think of plenty of ways that something like an Astra Militarum model or a Tyranid or even a Tau model could use this to the full advantage to reposition strategically, particularly if an opposing model, which becomes the target of that moving model, has superior firepower. Because if you're trying to move and you want to move as quickly as you can, there are going to be instances where you lose the ability to really respond to that incoming fire, and you want to keep that model protected as long as you can, particularly if you have a situation in a narrative campaign where a objective is on a raised platform. If it's on a second floor and you want to move models towards that second floor in a way which protects them from incoming fire, sure, it'll be slower, but it makes more sense to do that in a concealed way. Think about how that would apply in any kind of realistic environment where you're trying to move while under fire. If you cannot move in a way which involves you standing up and running, then you crawl, whether it's on your hands and knees or whether it's leopard crawling, like you just move by whatever means you can. Like this mechanic, I think, should be in Kill Team. If anything, crawl should be, because it's just so brilliant the way that it works, and I love that. And finally, in Necromunda, they have knockback. And when you think about the types of weapons that are in the Warhammer 40K universe, knockback is actually really interesting because if you're throwing grenades, and there are, of course, plenty of ways in which grenades work or explosives work in Kill Team, the more that you have a powerful exploding weapon, the more that there could be knockback. So let's say that you're using a Cyclone missile launcher against a Termagaunt, and you fire a frag at that Termagaunt. So because a frag weapon is a blast weapon, then the knockback, which may increase its effects outside of causing wounds, means that horde armies need to work harder against armies which might be smaller in number but having more advanced weaponry. So if I've got a Death Watch Terminator and I'm facing off against a lot of low-value Tyranid models, being able to force them through knockback to move further and be slowed down in any of their advances protects those kind of models in a way from being bogged down. And I think that knockback is actually a really clever way, again, to use your weapons strategically to interfere with movement, which is one big, big objective of having firepower superiority, but also being able to interact with your environment in a way which uses it against them. So in Necromunda, one really interesting aspect of knockback is that you can actually blast a model against a wall or a door or something. And usually the model which is knocked back is thrown against that, because the knockback typically pushes a model away by a few inches, but if there is a wall or a door or something there, then they can't move that full distance. And when they can't move the full distance, which is forced by the blast, the damage of the attack is increased by one. And you can already see the potential for that with multi-damage weapons. And it makes wall hugging important, because when you're in a scenario where you're dealing with firepower superiority, sticking to walls and making use of cover is important. But if you stick too closely to it, then you can be subject to knockback. So also think about how that can work really interestingly with your blast weapons and interfering with advances. So cover having both a positive and a negative for models that are really clinging to that and using it in a very codependent way. And finally, the part of Necromunda's rule set, which actually sounds like it's really interesting, is how its close combat features work. So in the basic Necromunda rules, what it describes is influences like backstabbing on the weapon strength. So if your attacking character is not within a target's vision arc, i.e. where it's facing, then you can add one to its strength. So it increases the benefits to actually sneaking up on someone. And your models can also parry. And having a parry mechanic to sort of interfere with the way the successful hits are landing makes actual fighting in close combat, which can be quite desperate and brutal, a little bit more in depth as well. Necromunda has an aspect where power weapons can not be parried except by other power weapons, and I think that's maybe taking it a little bit too far, as it would apply to Kill Team, because not every faction has a great deal of access to things like power weapons, so it would put some factions at a real strong disadvantage. So that would be where I draw the line from that respect, and I think that a lot of the other rules really just reflect the 40k and Kill Team rules as far as damage and everything is concerned, and they're things which we're already familiar with. So taking a look at Necromunda, I can already see that it's a really intense and interesting and in-depth way of playing, and this is just the really basic rules that we've looked at. Like, there is a whole additional part of Necromunda which is not part of this episode, which talks about psychic or psychology of your models, and we're not even touching on that. So it takes it that one step further to really draw on the coolness and the intelligence of your models. And I think that's probably one thing which Necromunda is doing really well. It's giving a lot of instances where your models have character and depth to them in a way that you want them to survive, rather than just throwing them into melee. And I think that's really interesting. So there are plenty of things which I can see being good opportunities for Kill Team to improve on by learning from Necromunda. What does everybody else think about these really basic Necromunda rules which seem to work really well? Is there anything which I perhaps have shown an interest in which you disagree with? Or is there anything that you doubt would be as effective as I'm suggesting? We're going to take a break now, but have a think about this discussion of Necromunda and what we can learn from these alternate systems. There is so much that can be improved on when Kill Team receives its second version, and I look very forward to seeing what that looks like in the future. So we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Tabletop Simulator for 40K. Welcome back to the second and final part of Episode 5 of Season 1 of Slamhammer. What I wanted to touch on in this final part of this episode was Tabletop Simulator, and there are some reasons for that. A lot of people will have found, especially right now, that discretionary spending is really hard to justify. Budgets are not endless, and I say that as someone who has a pretty high disposable income in most cases, but there's a lot of things that he needs to budget for. The recent price adjustments to the Warhammer range would probably come across to some as pretty unwelcome, but unfortunately it's a necessary part of Games Workshop doing business. And to that extent, I think the pattern is pretty unavoidable. And the 9th edition Warhammer 40K is likely to be one with a fairly high entry level. So for those who can afford it and can participate in it fully, that's really fantastic and all the more power to you. Like I've said previously, if 9th edition is appealing, I do want to get involved, but I'm going to wait and hopefully learn more about its features and how it differs from the previous edition before outlaying money to get involved. I've already got a lot of models which I can just build and paint up so that I have a freestanding Death Watch army. Like, that's actually not the problem here, because I've already got them. I just haven't built some of them. It's actually figuring out whether or not I actually find the rule set interesting compared to Kill Team, which for me is far better. There are going to be some who just cannot justify it, and for those people, I feel for you, especially right now. You know, I've been in those situations where there just isn't the money to go around, and you're getting by, but something like a hobby which, you know, is costing you $100 for something quite basic can be really hard to get stuck into. And for that reason, I figured I would talk about Tabletop Simulator as an alternative again to something like Wrath and Glory or Death Watch RPG, which I've played in a D&D type way. Because while D&D format role-playing games are appealing for some, it might not appeal to all. Tabletop Simulator, as the name suggests, is a tabletop simulation engine which has its own physics engine, so you can use your models to interact with one another. So there will be generated characters for your 40k universe which are developed by the community, and they can be moved around and interacting with their environment without the animation aspects, as you can expect, because this isn't a 40k game. There are so many different people who are on YouTube playing with Tabletop Simulator in a 40k environment, and particularly with Kill Team, and there is a large community out there developing resources for especially the Primaris Marines. So if you find yourself in a position where you cannot afford 40k, do consider if tabletop gaming is still something you're really interested in, whether Tabletop Simulator might be for you. This is not a plug for Tabletop Simulator, but I would stress, especially right now, that there has to be other means for people to remain engaged, particularly when the hobby becomes more expensive from an entry level. For an Australian, it's going to cost you $29 to get from Steam, right? And presumably, if you're going to participate with Tabletop Simulator, you'll have a computer which can handle it. Tabletop Simulator is not going to be asking for a lot from a driver perspective. So if you've got a reasonably powerful computer for gaming, then you're going to be able to run this, and that's not a problem. So when you get this, you're also going to need to get the different assets for Tabletop Simulator. And there is a very large community, both on Reddit and also through Discord, which are there to help you get started. So if you are interested and you do think that maybe your budget cannot accommodate some of these more expensive additions to the game, think about these different ways of engaging and do have a look at Tabletop Simulator and all the resources which are now being made available through different channels like Reddit and Discord. Okay, because at times like this, some of the best responses to these ongoing price increases are for people to not pay the prices which Games Workshop is putting out. I don't want to be overly critical of Games Workshop, but some of the prices they are charging for their model range is a little bit inappropriate, particularly during periods like this. And I appreciate all the work which goes in behind it. I appreciate all the legwork that they're doing to get people engaged with the hobby in different ways. But right now is probably not the time to jack up your prices when they're already pretty high from an entry level. Okay, so if you do need different ways to engage with the hobby, think about those ways of interacting. And then also, if this comes across as too expensive, or if you don't have the equipment to get started, because if you don't have a computer which is capable of accessing something like Tabletop Simulator, then getting one is going to be more expensive than getting started in the hobby, honestly, at least from an initial perspective. So then have a think about how Wrath and Glory or something like the Death Watch RPG might be useful for you. These resources are available online, so do have a look for them. But also have a think about ways in which you can start splitting these new boxes with people who you play 40k with. Luckily, these starter sets are going to be pretty easily separable, and my suspicion is that, much like Saga of the Wolf, splitting something right down the middle with Gozgul in one section and Ragnar Blackmane in the other is going to probably be the norm going forward, rather than being something which is really quite awkward. What I would recommend is having a conversation now with the people who are in your gaming group. Are those people interested in buying 9th edition starter set when it comes out? And if so, can you split it? If there are ways that you can split or break down your costs or share your costs, think about that very closely. But also have a look to what other resources are available online. I'm sure there's going to be a lot. And if at an absolute max, you're finding all this unaffordable or really hard, just do make sure that you're staying engaged with the community, because there are people out there who genuinely want the participation and support and communication with those who also share the same interests that we do. And for everybody who is in the hobby, I know that right now is really tough, especially in places like the United States. Like, I really feel for all of you right now with everything that is going on. Not delving into the politics, but I feel for you. And particularly in places like Europe, where some of the coronavirus outbreaks have been a little bit more pressing. Like, do stay connected to one another, stay engaged with one another. If you are isolated, think about the ways in which you can connect. And if you can connect with others and participate in hobby, then that's a hell of a lot better than being isolated on your own. That was all I wanted to say on Tabletop Simulator as an alternative way of engaging with the hobby. Thank you again for joining me on this podcast. In the remainder of Season 1, we're going to be delving again back into the tabletop format of 40K and Kill Team, particularly now that the tabletop format is a lot more accessible, at least in Victoria, Australia, and I assume in the other states as well. Also in Season 1, we're going to start our interview series. The interview series will involve discussions with different hobbyists about their interest in Warhammer 40K in Kill Team, and for those who are very much into the painting and modeling side of the hobby, what their artistic influences are. So it's going to draw upon the basics in episodes 2 and 3, and then try and get some different perspectives on these topics, such as how to build something to meet a desired aesthetic, or how to really improve your painting skill. It's going to be perceived through this different lens, because the more views that you can access through this podcast format, the better. And there are so many talented people out there who can lend a lot of advice and support through this format, which is in a really accessible way. And I feel like this podcast is just going to add a lot more value to the community, where I can be as helpful as possible, but also help others help you in a really open and casual and fluid way. So do keep your eyes out for future episodes of Slam Hammer, which touch on these kind of topics and then delve really deeply into the tabletop format of these games. And as I was saying at the start of the episode, I'm going to be putting together a Facebook page that will help everybody keep across developments in the podcast. There will be disruption to some of the releases in the future, just because of things that are happening outside of work and this podcast. So if there are any interruptions to that release schedule, which is still intended to be weekly, then I will keep everybody posted on there. And there will also be other ways which you can engage with the different segments and user content through that medium. So there'll be future details on that when they are available. Thank you again for your time. Have a fantastic day, and see you in the next one.